government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
And I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, the Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time the Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced. Thousands of books have been written. And yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, and 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is, and that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The motto of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. This is Beth. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, Countdown to Disclosure. I apologize that we started a few minutes late. There were some glitches in the system. But I'm very happy to welcome Gary Heseltine here. Mr. Heseltine is a retired police officer in the United Kingdom, and he is creator of PRUFOS, a police database which maintains an unofficial capacity. The database was launched publicly in January of 2002, and it is a place for police officers in the United Kingdom to report sightings of UFOs. Mr. Heseltine is also one of the principal investigators on the Rendlesham Forest Bentwaters case, and he is beginning a new endeavor, UFOTruthMagazine.com. So I will welcome Gary now and let him tell us more about these things.
Hiya, Beth. Thanks for having me on. Can I just correct you on the pronunciation of my name? It's Gary Heseltine.
Ah, sorry. I apologize.
Tine.
Thought I had it right. Okay, got it.
And small thing, but no, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, glad to talk to you again. I want you to know that I've shared your information on our radio program twice before, and we listened to your testimony here yesterday.
Right. And what was the reaction?
Whenever I give out the phone numbers for people to call in, I don't get calls. And I've had emails and people say, Beth, we so much enjoy listening to you talking that we don't want to call and interrupt you.
Well, that's fair enough. You've got quite a captivating voice, Beth.
So everybody, if you'd like to talk to Gary, please do. I invite you to call in. We'll be here for 2 hours. So, Gary, where would you like to begin?
Why don't we start with the citizen hearings? Because that seems a logical place to start. It's been a very important event, something which I think historically will be a landmark occasion.
I walked away from that knowing that I would never be the same again, and realized that really, with the testimony going out over the airwaves and over the internet, this world will never be the same again.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, I'm perhaps not as optimistic that there will be a breakthrough as quick as what Steve would like. I certainly would like that, but I'm a realist as a detective or former detective, and what we're stacked against is a very powerful machine that has been very successful at keeping the truth away from the public for over 60 years. So, you know, to actually make a significant breakthrough soon would be great. I certainly think that we're on the right roads, but I still say that the citizens' hearings will come back whenever it's this year, next year, 5 years, 10 years after I'm dead. But the citizens' hearings will prove a landmark event in the disclosure process.
Yes, they will. What was the greatest thing that impacted you from the citizens' hearing?
I was sat next to you. They'll be talking about us now a lot of the time.
Yeah.
We were very close. We were within 20 or 30 feet of the participants on the various panels before the senator and the congressman and women. And so we were right there at the time when all the quality testimony was given. Having been a detective for over 20 years and a police officer for nearly 24 years, I can tell you that apart from the clapping, which you wouldn't get in a courtroom situation, apart from that, it was pretty close to a kind of a proper police environment, a courtroom situation. People solemnly gave their testimony, and the quality of the testimony, by and large, was superb. I think the first day there was a moment which I said at the time was a bit of a eureka moment when Congresswoman Kilpatrick kind of summed up at the end of the first day, when literally I don't think they realised what they'd fully walked into in terms of the level of evidence that was going to be presented to them. But she was the first person who at the end stood up in a kind of almost in an involuntary motion and saluted the work that Steve had done. And quite spontaneously, everybody in the room, which must have been at that time on the first day, well over 200 people,
right,
unanimously stood up. And she was the first person to say, based on one day's testimony of evidence presented to this panel, I firmly believe that we should have congressional hearings now. And that, to convince somebody of that experience within one day of open testimony, unless she's lying, which I have no reason to believe she is, was to me a eureka moment.
I completely agree. In fact, I noticed specifically on Wednesday morning, after two full days, and they still had 3 days to listen to, that the body language, their shoulders were shrugged. They were all kind of sitting low in their chairs. And there was a very solemnness where they realized what they had then, on Wednesday morning, what they had gotten into and how serious this was and how much it impacted every aspect of life in our world.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think certainly some of them were absolutely almost to the point of being overwhelmed with the brain data. They were brain dead because there was that much quality information going in, you know. But I well remember, I think it was on the Thursday when Congressman Merrill Merrill Cook was absolutely not for six, I think, by the testimony of pilot Colonel Santa Maria, Oscar Santa Maria, who basically chased a UFO and was shooting at it in a dogfight. And I think throughout the week he'd clung to his belief that there had to be another explanation. Right. But when he heard that testimony, his jaw, you could see, was virtually on the floor. His body language was absolutely, Jesus Christ, I didn't realise that there was this kind of evidence. And to see that was quite a powerful moment. And he was absolutely gobsmacked by the pilots, because there's nowhere to go, which is what I've always said, that for me, the pilot cases are the strongest evidence that we have that points towards ET contact. because if a pilot doesn't know what he's chasing in broad daylight, after millions of dollars of his flight education,
then he should decide to fly. Experience.
Sorry?
And decades of experience as a fighter pilot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a joke. You know, but the sheer quality of some of the panels absolutely blew them away. And I think that I was very impressed with Congresswoman Kilpatrick and Senator Gravel, who to me kind of took the lead early on and maintained that throughout the week. I think they were absolutely bowled away. But I think when you talk about shoulders going down, you're right. But for me, it wasn't just about brain overload. It's about the fact that I think they were actually embarrassed to a degree, embarrassed by the sheer quality of the evidence that they were totally unprepared for. And they felt somewhat embarrassed that they, one, didn't know about the extent of the cover-up. Right. By their own political machinery.
Yes.
And two, that how could something so obviously evidential as what was presented have been kept from the public for over 60 years? And I think they were resigned.
I completely agree with you. When you speak about Thursday and Congressman Cook, not to pick on him, but when he heard Dr. Sun from the People's Republic of China relay what had happened with extraterrestrials, he kind of interrupted him. He was in complete disbelief. Dr. Sun is known internationally. He's known very well throughout China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, but also internationally known for his work. And he was saying something to the effect, "Are you serious? Is this real? What does your government say about this?" He wanted some other proof than this world-renowned man, you know, and he couldn't believe what he was hearing again, you know. And as the shoulders were shrinking on the committee, you know, if I had been in their shoes, I would have felt the same way. Then for the witnesses' chests kind of poofed out because a little bit meaning that, finally, someone's listening to us. This feels good. You know?
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I was quite forceful during my time on the panel, because I think at one point there was some confusion as to why we're there. We're not there. We weren't there to debate the ethics of where they're from, what they're doing, although it's a logical question from their point of view. But the real reason we were there was to present the evidence that we've been trying to present for over 60 years. So, we only have 5 days to get this right. So
right.
There was a sense of frustration on my part with some of the philosophical questions that came
right.
out of it. They were just trying to understand it, and I kind of understand that. But the reality is that we had 5 days to show them the evidence. So that's what I wanted to concentrate on.
I was doing the same. I was listening to the questions and I was checking that the panels were answering with known research to every question. And I was constantly analyzing it that way. And the biggest part that you brought out for me in your testimony was Rendlesham Forest in the morning testimony when Jim Peniston and John Burroughs were speaking, there was kind of it was very vague if this was a nuclear facility or not. And you said, you know, tell us what you said.
I said, cut the crap. I worked on two nuclear bases doing exactly the same job. And the base at Bentwaters, the nuclear weapon storage area, was the same as the supplementary storage area. That's the British name for the same area that it was at RAF Larbrook. It was identical layout, design and everything. So, and the numbers involved, it's definitely a nuclear issue. But there is obvious reasons why people skirt around that in terms of senior officers. I don't quite understand why Jim and John skirt around it, because they're like me, you know, they weren't senior officers. Yes,
right.
They were bound by oaths, but in a sense they've already discussed the issue.
Right.
So for me, I think Jim Peniston was asked pertinently by Senator Gravel. He said, look, you know, nothing's going to happen to you. was it a nuclear base? And he kind of said, well, I can neither confirm or deny, which is what, like, Colonel Holt, who was then the deputy base commander as a lieutenant colonel at the time, he would say that even now. But the reason why a senior officer would say it is because, in reality, there were more nuclear weapons at Bentwaters that shouldn't have been there. That's the key thing. Politically shouldn't have been there than anywhere else in the UK. Now, people were thinking that other US bases in England had significant weapons, but nobody knew that they were there at Bentwaters. So, in effect, to admit that they were there for a senior officer would implicate possibly a major political furore politically, because it would mean that they were in breach of probably the UK nuclear arms treaties. So you can see why senior officers would not want to admit that it's a nuclear base for those reasons, and I fully understand that.
Well, I was very surprised when Jim Peniston said that, because in the U.S., we had this television show that was a dramatic reenactment of the case, and they mentioned nuclear arms all over that show. I think it was on the History Channel years ago, maybe in the 90s. And, you know, in the morning testimony, it was brought out about NATO, you know, keeping these nuclear weapons secret, maybe, you know, and also that the State Department of the United States took the case over within 48 hours. And they use the term international incident. So we don't know exactly all the details about all of that, but that the fact that he didn't confirm nor deny, there's so many YouTubes out there where they're talking about the nukes on that base. So I was really surprised he said that to the committee.
What you've got to understand is that if you move in a high visible profile in the media, you are interviewed countless times, whether it's be video, radio, newspaper, you cannot be inconsistent with what you say. So that's why you'll never hear me say that it's not ET, because 100% it is ET. And I will go to my grave saying that it was ET, because the evidence is there. Now, I think some people, for whatever reasons, are inconsistent, and lots of people forget what they've said in other shows for whatever reasons. But going back to what you originally said, I think Steve did a fantastic job throughout the week. Absolutely mammoth, fantastic undertaking, and all credit to him. But I do think, personally, that the Rendlesham Forest panel was the weakest session of all the week's testimony that I heard, and I was virtually there for everyone.
I would agree.
Not because of the quality of Jim and John's evidence, which is very powerful,
right,
but the structure was there were two sessions allocated, and Steve actually, I did say this to Steve later, and he did accept totally what I'd said. I said what should have happened is in the first session, you should have had myself, Linda Moulton Howe, and Peter Robbins, as the three principal researchers, set out the full sequence of events.
Explain to the committee what actually happened.
They were going into it blind. And
yeah,
that then set the scene for Jim, yes, and John in the second morning session to tell their story. Because obviously, right, they focused on their incident, which is highly important. But they were obviously not going to talk too much about other nights because they weren't there or had less involvement. So for me, the structure of that was wrong. And if anybody, you know, I say that Rendlesham Forest is one of the very best cases in the world. I think it's personally better than Roswell, for the simple reason that where else do you get a deputy base commander of what was a nuclear facility admitting in a one-page teaser memo to the MOD that, one, there'd been a structured craft landed, two, there'd been physical evidence left by the landed craft, and three, that on the third night he went out there and saw multiple UFOs himself. And that's the reason why it's more important than than Roswell, for
absolutely,
that very document. I personally think that the Holt Memorandum, as it's called, written by Lieutenant Charles Holt at the time, is arguably one of the top 10 documents in the field of ufology.
I agree completely. And speaking as an American, I will say many Americans, number one, haven't heard about Rendlesham in the first place. The people who are into the topic have heard of it, and they don't even know that it went over a three-night period. There were three different events on three different nights.
Absolutely. And that's
the problem the committee was having.
Yeah, and I think that because the scene wasn't set for them to take right. in the gravity of the case, it came across as being underwhelming, shall we say. Not through anybody's fault, not through right. John, but if they were probably thinking, well, what's so good about this case other than what Jim and John are saying?
The committee became focused on, well, why won't they let you have your records? And I wanted to yell at them because this is bigger than Roswell and you're not going to get any records from them.
Well, I got frustrated with the medical side. Their records aren't being released, and that is wrong. And the panel right. then got into a kind of a 45-minute debate about how it's wrong that the government is depriving them of their records. But
yeah, we need to talk to the VA about this and the president. And it's like, no, this is about something different than what you're talking
right.
about.
So in what was a 1.5-hour second session, 45 minutes was lost really on an right. open debate about how wrong it is to deny them the records. Well, the good news is that they backed a motion to get their records produced, which is obviously good.
But, as well they should, of course.
And absolutely, of course they should. And it clearly shows that they would have been treated in a very odd way for something that supposedly doesn't exist, this problem. But I felt at times that the congressmen and women found it very difficult to get to grips with the scale of the deception. And they were almost in disbelief with all the great testimony that was coming out. They basically, I think, struggled to come to terms with the quality of the evidence, and therefore they would then go into kind of philosophical debates to try to get themselves to understand what was going on.
Yeah, but I agree.
But that, for me, wasn't the purpose of the hearing. It was there for us to give our evidence in a unique situation before people who had served 80 years collectively in public office.
Right. And regarding their medical records, they had some very unique issues. For example, Jim Pennison actually touched the craft. And so they're both suffering from some kind of radiation sickness, maybe. And the other issue with their with their medical records is that they were messed with afterwards by agents and maybe using drugs and who knows what else, maybe implanting false memories. So their case is very unusual.
Well, what in UFO terms, what we have independently from at least five of the witnesses involved in over the three nights is that there was interrogations to some individuals, but to at least five of the people after the third night of activities. Now, that's very unusual, and that was confirmed by Holt, that he knew people were being mistreated, and he was being frustrated by that. He knew that there were interrogation sessions, not to the level of what's emerged, but he knew that something very odd was taking place, and certainly the Office of Special Investigation were involved initially, but several people reported that there were other officers there, and I think Jim Pennison even says that there was a British officer there, or somebody from the British government that was there, an official interrogating him at one point. So there clearly is some meddling with the minds. I know Larry Warren personally. I've talked to him many times, and he was certainly a very messed up individual. By what's happened, and it's troubled his life. I think that's fair to say for all his life. And it was absolutely wrong what's happened. The reality is in terms of looking at the where we are now, 33 years on, I think we've probably got 70% of the jigsaw. If you think of a 100-piece jigsaw, we've probably got 70% of the pieces. I suspect we'll never get beyond 75%. Maybe 80% at most, that things will come out in the future. But what's clear is that there was an attempt at some point by certain agencies to one, implant memories, two, confuse people, three, change people's testimony. As in Cabanzac, they were saying to him, you saw a lighthouse. He said, I didn't see a lighter. You saw a lighthouse. I didn't see a lighter. You right. saw a lighthouse. So that kind of thing. So when you collectively look at it, there was some kind of disinformation or cover-up exercise going on, which again, adds to the gravity of what's actually occurred there. But I don't think we'll ever go beyond the 80%. We're never going to get all the pieces. It's simply too complicated. And I suspect that there may well be some major issues, jigsaw pieces about interrogation to come out later. Who knows what happened in reality to Jim and John when they were out in the craft? Because we know that from the abduction phenomena, there are some aspects that will say that Jim and John were missing for quite a while. And that they couldn't raise them on the air whilst they
right.
didn't openly remember things. It's possible something could have happened to them during the time that they were near the craft. We don't really know. The danger is that one of the ways that things do tend to come out later is through hypnosis. Certainly with the abduction accounts is often the case. But in the end, in terms of evidential, police evidential terms, anything that came out under hypnosis wouldn't really be evidence at all. It would be anecdotal in terms of a court of law. It's anecdotal evidence. What comes out under hypnosis would not be, in my eyes, proper evidence. But it would be interesting and would be compelling. But it wouldn't be classed as police evidence, I don't think.
Right, I agree. And when I look back on Roswell, so many people say, well, you know, 1947, the government was worried about the Nazis. They were worried about the Russians. And if you look back at 1980, we were at the peak of the Cold War. It was the first year of Reagan's second term. And unless you're over 45 years old, you can't even remember what that time was like.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's one of the things that I stress when I lecture about Rendlesham is the political perspective at that time. And again, had we have had that first morning session on Rendlesham, then I would have made this point very clearly and set the political tone. It was the time of the hostage crisis.
Right.
But more significantly, it was the time of the Polish shipyard workers under Lech Wałęsa, for the first time challenging what was the old Soviet authorities. And basically, the Soviets didn't know what to do. And at the time of the Rendlesham incident, there were literally hundreds of thousands of Soviet troops massing on the borders of Poland. And it looked very much to the world that they were going to go in the same way that they'd been into Hungary many years earlier to keep it within the Soviet domain. In the end, that didn't happen. And I think by 1991, it was all over. But certainly, in the political context, this is very rarely made out. And for me, what comes out of the Rendlesham case, having investigated it with Colonel Holt and others for the last 5 years or so, what comes over to me is that this was about nuclear weapons by UFOs. And this was a nuclear inspection at a time of great world crisis, i.e. the Soviets on the border. And they came to check out the nuclear weapons, which Colonel Holt admitted that he'd changed a radio frequency when he saw beams being shone down onto the base. He changed the radio frequency from his location. He couldn't see that the beams were going directly down into the weapon storage area, but it was in that general direction. So he changed his radio frequency to the weapon storage area tower, which was way above everything. It's 80 feet high, 40 feet above any surrounding tree at that time. And he heard the guy. He confirmed it on video to me personally, whilst up at the top of that tower doing some private filming, that he heard the guy in the tower saying there are beams coming down into the weapon storage area bunkers. Now, that was one hell of an admission for him to make. And that, you know, he's not going to say that if it didn't happen, not somebody of his rank and reputation. So that was an incredible moment. And so, therefore, you have got a nuclear inspection by UFOs who detected that at a time of world crisis, there were nuclear weapons, more nuclear weapons there than anywhere else in Britain, that two shouldn't have been there. And I think that's why they came.
I agree. And the other part of the perspective is with Ronald Reagan in office and the things he was doing with Margaret Thatcher back then and United Nations and NATO. Besides that, we had George H.W. Bush and Henry Kissinger and that group playing into politics. And this, with the nuclear weapons, there's things behind the scenes in secret space program that we don't even know about right now. And Ronald Reagan was trying to sell the, you know, the shield in the sky for Star Wars. I don't even know the whole story. I just know that had to be a part of it.
Absolutely. You know, So
there's even a bigger thing that we're not even looking at that we don't even know.
Go on.
You know, yeah.
No, I agree. There were political things happening behind the scenes, and we don't know because we're not in the need to know. We're never going to know just how much UFOs have played a part in orchestrating political history as it's unfolded. You know, I honestly believe that most prime ministers and senior politicians of all countries don't really know what's going on. Only a handful of people do know the real extent of the ET cover-up. And so therefore, who knows what these people who do know what's going on, how it has shaped secretly the latter half of the 20th century and the early part of the 21st century. We don't know, but that'll probably come out within the next 50 years or as and when the truth embargo, whatever you want to call it, disclosure happens.
Yeah, I agree. Would you like to just briefly speak about the 3 days? Because I think in the United States, a lot of people don't know about the 3 days.
Right. Well, there were three consecutive nights of UFO activity at RAF Bentwaters and Woodbridge. On the first night, effectively, just to sum it up, cutting a long story short, lights were seen approximately 300 metres away from the east gate of the base, and people went out on foot eventually into the forest, and Jim Pennison and John Burroughs came across a landed craft. Pennison went forward, walked around it, took photographs, drew pictures in his police pocketbook, and made notes, etc. Noticed that there were symbols on the side, which he put in his pocketbook. And he says he was doing that for about 45 minutes as John Burroughs was stood nearby, watching incredulously, no doubt. It was very weird. When they went back, they went back to the shift commander and told a sanitized version, which I completely understand why they would do that. Because anybody who'd done come across that would think they're going to think I'm lunatic, my career's up the swanny. And so they gave a sanitized version saying they saw a structured craft moving through the forest.
But right. They didn't. Can I just interject something?
Yeah, go on.
I remember, maybe I'm wrong, I remember Jim saying at the testimony at the citizens' hearing that he saw that Jim was in a beam of light, and rather than watching, he was kind of not, he was immobile in a beam of light. That's what I remember hearing there.
Yeah, no, there's that aspect to it. I don't think we're never going to know entirely what they saw. I think what they, if you remember, in the lead up to that first night, as they approached the forest, there's lots of static, the hairs on the back of the neck are standing up, they feel electricity, literally across their body, static electricity. Something clearly is very odd. And I don't think we're fully certain exactly what happened, because there is this kind of time element where I remember when they got back, I think Jim Pennison was challenged by another sergeant who said, "You were gone for ages off the air. You've gone for hours and not the 45 minutes as what Jim had said." So, you know, there's still some things that we don't know about there. But clearly, based on the drawings that Jim had done, there was a very structured craft there. Now, so that's the first night, essentially. cutting into the next night. And that the first night was just after midnight on going into Boxing Day on the 26th of December. So Christmas night into Boxing Night, and the events start kicking off just after midnight in the early hours of Boxing Day, the 26th. Mm. Cutting a long story short for your audience, the second night, less well known, but a number of people have come forward now to confirm it, where I'm happy that it's occurred, is that basically another light is seen by a guard at the East Gate the following night, the night of the 26th. Going into the 27th, a red fiery light is seen to drop into the forest. That's reported by one of the air women guards called Laurie Bowen. She reports it, and as it turns out, when this is broadcast, the shift commander, Lieutenant Bonnie Tamplin, was on mobile patrol at the time. So she said, "I'll respond to it now." We have sketchy accounts, really, but because she's never come forward, but we have confirmed accounts that basically she goes to the forest and she has an encounter with a light that appears to come into the cab of her vehicle, stop for a moment right in front of her, and then go out through the open window of the other side of the vehicle. So much distress was caused that she's over the radio. Now, this is the bit that's confirmed, because several officers have gone on record saying that they heard her distress calls saying that something's in the cab, and basically she was distraught, and that Sergeant Bobby Ball, who turns up on the third night of activities as well, he was the first to respond. And what kind of confirms this all is that when Colonel Holt gets involved, which is effectively on the third night, he's told earlier in the day that she's had to be relieved because something happened to her in the forest, which all adds up to a circumstantial picture that something very profound happened to her that upset her greatly. So that's the second
belief. Right. I remember you saying she wasn't relieved for a shift. She was relieved for some time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She was, I think, effectively went sick straight away. I don't know the full details. What I can say is that, I would sincerely hope that she might be listening, but I believe someone has passed me some details that I believe now says that we've got an address for her, that I will try to make some level of contact with her. I'd love her to come forward. She can do it confidentially or whatever, so she's listening. Yep. I was a detective for almost, a police officer for almost 24 years and a detective for 20 years. I do offer a confidentiality service for anybody that approaches me, as with the police cases over my 11 years of research. So, you know, anybody that's listening who's got information on this, come forward. But I will be addressing that and trying to get a level of contact with her.
Wonderful. It would be a great gift, because
but I don't really want to speculate any more than that.
Right.
For obvious reasons, but sure. I do have an address, and I will make an attempt to contact her. So that's the second night. The third night, Colonel Holt, who was then a lieutenant colonel at the time, the deputy base commander, is at a Christmas function late on the evening of the 27th into the 28th, when Lieutenant Bruce England, who was his third in line, his deputy as it were, came and said that the UFO's been seen again. It's back. What's back? The UFO, it's back. And he then basically got told by Ted Conrad, who was the base commander, to go out and get this sorted with a view to actually debunking it. You know, let's get this sorted once and for all. Go out there and let's stop talking about nonsense of UFOs. So that was his mindset. He gathered a team of specialists. Four other people went out there with big light halls, the big light things to light up the forest. But they, whilst they were functioning perfectly on the base, as soon as they got into the forest, they wouldn't work properly. So that was odd. They went to by the time he got changed and got his team together, the UFO had disappeared. But he decided to go out to the landing site of Peniston and Burroughs from the first night, because he'd not been at that point. But this is, it raises an interesting question, because how did he get there if he'd never been? So it means that somebody must have took him who had been, and that person, I believe, was Bruce England, who's never gone on record, and unfortunately we don't know where he is, so he holds a vital key. But the other four men have gone on record, but basically they go out into the forest, go to the landing site, and confirm that there is a perfect triangular set of indentations. There are three indentations, equilateral, about 9 feet in diameter, and that when they put the Geiger counter, which had been deliberately checked and calibrated before they went out, when they put the Geiger counter inside the depressions, i.e. they're at the same level of depression into the ground, same shape and size, so this is not animal markings, as some people have tried to say, the Geiger counter peaked just in those depressions. So it's not about how much they peaked, it's about the fact that they peaked. Why was there a change? And the only area that there was a change in is in the depressions. So that's what's significant, and that was later confirmed to be about seven times that of background radiation. So something strange had made that depression change its kind of electrical properties. So when you look at that, then whilst they're out at the site, there's one of the people with him says, hey, look, there's a light winking at us through the forest. Now, what this is often forgotten is that the trees at that time, they were in a forest, but it was a forest that had been purposely laid out in rows. And the trees were of a type that the branches were at about 8 to 9 feet off the ground. So effectively,
what kind of cypress or something like
I think it was like, I think there was cedar wood. I might be wrong.
Cedar wood, right.
Yeah, but basically the branches don't really start until about 8 to 9 feet off the ground. So if you can imagine, then you've got a full canopy of the forest, but underneath it, you're like inside a tent. Well, when they saw the red light that Holt described as like an eye winking at you with a black centre, that was underneath the canopy, and it was moving between the stems of the trees, the tree trunks, so you could be seen very clearly weaving its way. So then they leave the scene to follow this red light. They follow it as it zigzagged and made its way through the trees, up and down, left and right, but always under the canopy, until it emerged by the edge of a farmer's field. When they follow it and they get to the edge of the farmer's field, they for the first time get a look at it clearly. And when they look, they see that there's like a red object that appears to be dripping molten metal, although nothing was ever seen or recovered, but it appeared to be dripping liquid metal off the sides. It was seen to the left of what is now called the farmhouse, and it was cast in such a glow into the windows that initially it looked like the farmhouse was on fire. The key thing here is that from their position where they emerged from following it through the forest, that it was seen on the left of the farmhouse. And the reason for that is key. I'll show you in a minute. But basically, on the left of the farmhouse, they see for the first time in open area a red glowing object that was about the size of a car, approximately 15 feet off the ground, low to the ground, left of the farmhouse. Now, what happens then is that as they're watching, suddenly the red light breaks into or divides silently into five white objects.
Wow.
Right? Which is classic UFO behavior.
Right.
You know, so those people that tried saying that that's stealth, it's rubbish, because we can't do that yet. So the red object divides silently into five white objects that then disappear within their very quickly from sight.
They just blink off, right?
They just blink off, which is again, in my police testimony at the hearings, I talk about cases where a huge object the size of a football field suddenly blinks on, like turning a light bulb on and off, and so that was very similar. But then they see that there are other objects in the north and in the sky that are zigzagging around the sky, making incredible manoeuvres that planes can't do, ordinary technology can't do.
Right.
They cross the farmer's field by the side of the farmhouse. They go into a second farmer's field via a creek, which was then filled with quite a bit of water that's not there now. just a residue now, but they climb slightly into a second farmer's field. And then for me, one of the most incredible aspects of all of the case happens is that they're in this field, the second farmer's field, when one of the objects that they're looking around that's darting around in the sky comes towards them at high speed, stops above their head in silence, and then casts a what can only be described down as a laser beam, a white beam close to their position, within feet of their position, in the middle of the field for 15 to 20 seconds. Holt was thinking, is this a threat? Is it a level of communication? He didn't know, but they were all there in awe. Now, what you also have to remember that is lost often is that this case is significant because Colonel Holt went out with a dictaphone, which is quite a useful tool. He used to do it for making notes when he was at meetings. He'd just switch it on and say, I'm at this meeting, I need to write a letter, blah, blah. There were little notes to himself. Well, he went out, and there is an 18-minute tape recording of what is effectively about 7 or 8 live clips as he's at the landing site doing measurements. So you actually get a live snapshot of an ongoing UFO live event from a deputy base commander of a military, nuclear base. So again, this is something that raises it to a level way beyond evidential terms that we normally get.
And right. So important. Because apparently when he was speaking, his tone would raise and you could hear his adrenaline and his excitement at what was happening.
Well, some people said that at first, when it first emerged, they said, it can't be true. It's got to be made up. But somebody like Holt is not going to say he's made a tape with his reputation if he's made it up. So it's been checked and it is bona fide tape. And basically, you have a snapshot of a live event. And at one point, it's saying that the object's coming towards us. It's coming towards us, So right. There's the real excitement if that was me or you, I think we'd be in exactly the same position of being excited, bewildered, frightened, a mixture range of emotions. But effectively, that's what happens. And so multiple objects are seen. After this beam goes away, the objects go off into the sky in various different directions. And then at one point, Holt notices that there are beams being shone down towards the base. And that's when he changes that radio frequency because he sees a beam coming down towards the base. He can't be certain that it's whereabouts on the base, and that's why he changes the radio frequency. And the tower operator is confirming that beams were coming down into the storage bunkers, which is obviously a major development. And he tells me later that he then went the next day and asked Colonel Williams, who was the person he was ultimately responsible to, had the ordnance been affected? And I don't think he ever got a satisfactory answer. But I suspect that if anybody who had been at the citizens' hearings and heard about the Minuteman missiles from Robert Salas and others going offline, well, whilst they weren't launch capable in that way, they were there designed to be supplied to aircraft that would take off armed with a nuclear weapon, so it wasn't quite the same. But, who knows what happened. But I do absolutely feel that if beams had been shone down into the nuclear storage bunker, it was a scan of what was in there, and I suspect it's because of the weapons that shouldn't have been there. So it was a scan of what was inside the bunkers, and who knows whether they were affected or not. But certainly, I would think that they would have been checked out secretly afterwards. And there you have it. So 3 nights of incredible statistics and evidence. Where else do you have evidence confirmed by a base commander of a landed craft that there is physical trace evidence? The trace evidence is consistent with an object landing. Broken branches were found at the scene when they put what was called a star scope, which was an image intensifier, it detected latent heat from 2 days prior, which was very unusual. The sap marks were unusual where the branches had broken off. There was a blast area within the middle of the triangle that was found consistent with some kind of propulsion system taking off. There is so much wealth of documentary and physical evidence and witness testimony to make it an incredible case. And I've written a film script after mm-hmm. collaborating with Colonel Holt for the last 5 years, which he's endorsed. You know, it's been a long process that's gone through many redrafts, as you'd expect, as more things have emerged. But I'm pretty happy with it now. I'm getting very good, generally very good feedback from certain screenwriters that I've approached to review it. So I think we're very close to having something that tells probably the best account yet over the 3 days. You know, we're pretty much ready to go. And people have said that, you know, I've got two versions now, because basically people have said, I've always dreamed that this would make a brilliant feature film, not in terms of Independence Day, not to make loads of money, but if you told this story truthfully,
right,
I think it has the potential to change many people's perceptions, the ordinary person on the street, man or woman who have no interest in the subject. Right. But if this was done properly, it really has the potential to make them think. And if they came out of the cinema thinking, this is real, this actually happened, that would be a success. Not that it wouldn't turn them into ET believers, but just to make them think. And that's why I'm determined not to sell out for loads of money, because it's not about money for me. It's about telling the truth, which is really what the Truth Embargo is all about, what Steve Bassett is saying. We must tell the truth. And yes, I'm a nobody. So in reality, if you do get somebody approach you, they'll say, yeah, we believe in that, Gary. And at some point, you're going to have to probably make a decision to get it made, and you effectively hand over the script. Now, that's the critical time, because that's when it could be turned into Independence Day. And if it was, that would be a tragedy. I'm determined to hang on to it for as long as I can, for waiting for somebody who detects that the world is now ready for a truthful UFO film. And if there's anybody listening that can help me in that regard, producers, directors, film stars, actors who've got influence to those kind of people, the decision makers that could get this made, then I'd like to be actively involved as the screenwriter. No doubt there will be some minor changes, but essentially it's all there. You know, you can't make up this story, you know, and what happens afterwards is incredible. You know, the fact that people are interrogated, taken down into bunkers, given, as in Jim Peniston's case, the man who actually touched the craft, he was given sodium pentothal, and they kept saying to him, draw it again, draw pictures again of it. You know, and it's clear that the people who came in afterwards, some of the specialist interviewers that came in afterwards, knew exactly what they were looking for. And there's a couple of people gone on record saying that certainly Larry Warren is one of them, that said that they were shown a montage of real UFO films that had been collected over the years, which over many years, there's several other people have been shown similar things military wise. So it makes me think that this is probably true, is that at the point that you are then let into the secret, they then show you some real evidence of gun camera footage, etc., etc., and you are left as to no illusions that this is a real extraterrestrial phenomena. I certainly believe that that's very, very likely to have happened. But the whole case is just fantastic. And, you know, you've got nuclear weapons, you've got three nights of activity, you've got ground trace evidence, you've got the deputy base commander seeing multiple UFOs himself, you've got documentary evidence when he writes the memorandum, you've got beams coming down into nuclear storage area, you've got the political climate at the time, and, you know, we just don't get that kind of case very often. And so it really, if done properly, and that's what I say, some people have said, right, a theatrical version has to be more character-based, so you have to take some of it out to develop the characters for a feature film element, which I've done. But also people have said the blow-by-blow count would make for an excellent docudrama series, 2 to 4 part series. So I've got two kind of scripts now, one the docudrama for a TV series and one a theatrical film. But either way, I'm determined to hang on to them until such a time as when somebody who genuinely is interested in this subject in the film world who believes that they are at ET, comes forward with the necessary backing to say, look, yeah, time is right to tell this story. And I think that time is approaching.
How I think soon, so, too. I don't know. On top of that, everything you said, I would also encourage any wealthy visionary who can fund the whole thing and help you be the primary to get it, just get it going, just do it. And the other thing I want to say is you brought out something at the citizens' hearing that I hadn't thought of before, which I think would be important to illustrate, is that this was an air base. This was not a small place, and that you were saying that there were regions of the base where there were guards 24/7, and there were guards on duty all night in these different places, and they saw these things. And there's so much controversy sometimes about this story, but you said there's other people out there, and they just haven't come forward yet.
And well, they saw I know for certain that there are many other witnesses. But I know for certain from my own experiences, having been in the Royal Air Force as a policeman and working on two nuclear bases, doing exactly the same job that they did. And right. When I talk about RAF Lahrbruck in what was then West Germany, was the base that's identical in layout to the one at Bentwaters in terms of the weapon storage area, and an identical layout in terms of the blast wall, the bunkers, the shape of the bunkers, where the tower is in relation to everything else. That's all the same. Now, the thing that I know that other people don't know is that the nuclear issue is a 24/7, 365 years procedure. It's very dealt with very seriously for obvious reasons. And that requires numbers of officers. And that night, over those three nights, there was literally 38 officers either on the site or on mobile patrol or in the CSC, the Central Security Control Building. But here's the thing. Let's just focus on that third night when Holt changes the radio frequency to the tower when he sees a beam from distance. Now, when that he hears on the radio that the guy in the tower is saying that there were beams going down to the storage bunker, well, here's your witnesses. On any nuclear site, there would be at least two people on roving patrol with machine guns, rifles, etc., walking round what is a very small site in reality in terms of the base. There might be 12,000 to 14,000 people collectively at Bentwaters and Woodbridge, but on the weapon storage area, it's way off away from the airfield in a little area, relatively small area. It was not a huge weapon storage area, and it's well away from everything else, so for the secrecy aspect, but there would have been, I am certain, at least two people walking round, US Air Force policemen, who were walking around with their guns when these beams were being shone down. Now, what I suspect would first happen is that the guy in the tower would see anything that was above the tree line in the forest, because at that time, anything near the base, the trees would have to be kept at about 40 feet high. That tower is 80 feet. He had 360 vision for obvious reasons. He's one of the key positions in defending a nuclear facility. Right. So he's going to be the first person. So if there is anything above the tree line, i.e. that flies up into the air, like these objects that Holt said, there was three to the north, two to the south, he would have seen all of that. This would have all been going on the radio. I would not be surprised if there were not multiple officers in that tower on that occasion because of all the activity and the excitement, nervousness that it would have been caused. But when the beams are coming down to that area, there were at least two other witnesses who've never been traced, never been named, who were walking around with guns. And I know that for certain because that's what I did when I worked on there, and it's a standard protocol. Americans might be slightly different. They may have had four. They may have had six, but there would have definitely been at least two roving around on that site. But what I suspect would have happened is that when the beams were being shone down, the guy in the tower would have seen the object approach. He would have been relaying that on the radio to Central Security Control. So they would have been in a right flat. What do we do? Do we send out an alarm? And I suspect what would have happened is that they would have deployed extra policemen from within Central Security Control to get out into what were preordained bunker positions, like Sanger positions, where you would go if you had an exercise, which you had every night to check your response times. They would basically deploy to certain specific areas, to gun emplacements, yeah, in case of a Soviet attack. That's what you practice for. So that it would be no different for them than it was for the UK bases and the German bases. So basically, when those beams are coming down, there's at least two roving around whilst it's happening, probably very, very frightened. And then I certainly think that others would have been deployed to set positions, and who knows what chaos could have happened. You could have even got to a scenario where they could have been firing at these things in sheer panic. Who knows? But it's certainly that there are other witnesses who have yet to come forward. But can you imagine the pressure after all these years of somebody who was one of those two men walking around who see this at close hand, and they've seen everything that's happened and the ridicule and the hassle that the men have had? Are they going to come forward and stick their heads up above the parapets? You can see why they might not want to.
It would be my hope, after seeing the citizens' hearings, that they would have a sigh of relief and feel that maybe things have changed because of Stephen's hard work, and maybe it is time to come forward now.
Well, yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I think the time is right to come forward, but you can certainly see at the time why they wouldn't come forward.
Absolutely. And live somewhere where no one knows where you are, of course.
Absolutely. And, you know, and people will say, Jim Penniston will say that when he took, which was, we've not discussed, but he went back after his sighting of the landed object on his own with some plaster of Paris, and he recovered three plaster casts of the three depressions. He needed that for some kind of evidence to hang on to himself. Well, he tells a story that one of those plaster casts disappeared on an internal flight in the US when his case went missing. He got his case back, and the only thing that was missing was the plaster cast, you know, which is a bit odd, don't you think? So, you know, I certainly think, and he has said, and other people have said that have been involved, that they felt their phones had been tapped. They'd been followed at various times. So if you were one of those people walking around on the base, that, of course, because people didn't know that it was a nuclear facility like that and that there were weapons there, these witnesses, it would have been very easy for them just never to come forward, because nobody had ever heard of them. Nobody ever linked them because they didn't know how the base worked. It's only because of my intimate knowledge of those nuclear side of things, that which is kind of strange that it's synchronicity wise that I happen to be that person, because nobody would have even known about this aspect if it wasn't for me. In that aspect, you know, the numbers of officers prove on duty prove that it's a nuclear base, and the fact that there's definitely other people roaming around, other witnesses who've yet to come forward. So nobody would have known that if I hadn't have done the same job. So that's good for the case, but it just highlights that we have only scratched 70% of the 100-piece jigsaw. But you can certainly see why people wouldn't want to come forward. If we get to the stage, I think, taking it out of the Rendlesham and to the broader issue of disclosure and potentially... Well, the motions that came out of the citizens' hearing event was basically four of the six senators and congressmen and women signed a motion to try to get, as I understand it, full open congressional hearings. And also there was going to be a mechanism to try to get a country, which I suspect will be one of the South American countries, to trigger an amendment at the United Nations that would again... lead to a world conference on UFOs. Now, if we got to that stage where we're actually allowed to present our evidence in public to the world's media, which would be there on those occasions for obvious reasons, then that's when the dam is about to break, when we get to that stage, because I don't see how the media could avoid proper congressional hearings. I don't see how the media could stay away from a UN hearing on it, because it, in a sense, it would have been given legitimacy to have them in the first place. So there would be a definite change of emphasis that this was moving into a legitimate field of discussion, moving it away from the long-held position of ridicule. So as and when we get to that stage, and hopefully many of the same people who were there at the citizen hearings who gave great testimony can be there again to do it before Congress or before the UN. I'd love to be involved in that personally because it was a unique and very privileged position. But when you, if the world were to openly see the evidence that was presented in the way that it was presented, yeah, with one or two minor improvements, which you will always get here and there, right, you, I think the overwhelming collective testimony was would knock the media for six, and I think that's when you'd have your breakthrough.
I'm a big fan of the UN resolution. I believe it was Antonio Hunes, and I may be saying his name wrong, who from Uruguay, I believe, who said that this has been in place at the United Nations since 1978.
Yeah, it was there when Grenada, the last country to, the last debate in the UN was when Grenada, the small country of Grenada, right, under Geary, brought forward a motion. And I think it was just suspended. They didn't really take any action.
Right.
I think it's an attempt to reactivate that motion that was still on the books, technically. And what it would take is it would take a country to say, look, we believe that there is ET contact, we need to have a debate about this. And I think there's going to be a real debate. And I know that from Steve Massey's point of view, I think privately would hope that America, that has taken the lead secretively worldwide, yeah, on this subject for over 60 years, suddenly realizes that the dam is about to break. And I think he wants America to take the lead and say, look, if there is going to be the dam breaking, we want to tell our story first rather than be shamed into second or third place kind of thing. I suspect that it's not going to be as simple as that. I suspect our best hope is with South America, where anybody that was at the hearings who knows about the subject will know that there's at least five or six countries who are close in South America, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Peru, etc., that are very close to saying, look, ET is real politically. But we only need one. That's the key thing. We only need one to trigger that genuine motion and that could lead to a proper worldwide debate at the UN. Personally, I think you're right. My favourite approach would be the UN, because this is a world problem and it's not an American problem. Right. Although America has dominated the secrecy and is still the most secretive government in the world on the subject, in a sense, this is a worldwide phenomenon and therefore should be addressed by a worldwide body, in my opinion.
There's an important point here where United States, because they've dominated the secrecy, they have the largest responsibility for accountability. And I feel that as a lobbyist, as a registered lobbyist for 16 years on the exopolitics advocacy movement, that perhaps Stephen Bassett knows things, has heard things that we don't generally know. And having followed the politics behind this for the last 4 years, you know, we know some things. We know that the Rockefeller Initiative in 2004 failed. We know that in 2009, John Podesta was sitting on 800 million documents that they wanted to have released on the topic. And Leon Panetta has been working behind the scenes. He was the chief of staff in the Clinton White House. He served as the head of the CIA. That was no mistake that President Obama put him in there. It put him in contact with documents. After that, he was moved to become the Department of Defense, Secretary of Defense for the United States. That put him into the Pentagon paperwork on these issues. And if you look at the news articles that were happening around that time, there was a big shakeup with the generals and with the ambassadors to Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you look, if you kind of delve a little bit deeper, there's something there where I feel that President Obama could come forward with this, but he would have to come forward with his military and intelligence. And I think those are the ones that are the sticks in the mud. But I'm hoping that these pressures are coming on now and they're realizing what will happen to them regarding accountability if China comes forward, if a Central American country comes forward first.
No, I agree. I think the pressure is mounting, and it would be fantastic if the pressure mounts to the, and we can get a South American country. I still think it's South America that should take the lead because they have been the most open. I was recently in Brazil at a major South American conference organised by AJ Javard from Brazil. And the attitude couldn't be more starkly different from that in the UK and in the US.
Yes.
There were hundreds of people. They had to close the doors. They could have filled the 500 seat venue twice.
Right.
Because there were so many, and that was just to meet the speakers, that they weren't actually saying anything as such. So the response from the public, but the attitude of the South American people and the attitude of the military and governments are certainly so different to what they are in the US. It really is brilliant to see. So for me personally, I hope that it's another country that forces the issue. Now, whether because they're about to do it, that America then suddenly thinks, "Oh, we have to get on board here, else we're going to look bad." Well, the bottom line is America's going to look bad anyway.
That's right.
Whenever or whoever forces the truth to come out by whatever mechanism, when that truth comes out, there will be an almighty backlash from the public towards America in particular, because they've kept their fingers in the pies and kept this secret for so long. And if we're talking about suppressed technology that could have benefited the world, and we shouldn't be driving around in our gas-guzzling cars and planes and jet engines that we could have had incredible propulsion systems years ago, and probably medical breakthroughs, et cetera, et cetera. Go on.
The hundreds of billions spent on secret space program, which kept the world in mass starvation and war in every country.
Well, that's right. I mean, you go on to a slightly different level and look at Earth as a planet and civilization and people. And we're not a very nice kind of people because we like killing each other. So, you can see why they might, ET, various species, I'm sure, look at us with thinking that we're a bit primitive and we just like killing each other. And it'd be hard not to pick up the news at 6 o'clock anywhere around the world and see that that's not a pretty fair reflection. Everybody says that as and when contact is acknowledged in whatever form, that it will be the most significant breakthrough for mankind. I totally agree with that. We know, the people who have been following this subject for a long time have known that that's a reality for a long time, but as and when mainstream gets on board, it's going to be a real earth shaker. And when the media have actually played along with this lie, there's going to be a backlash towards the media, but an even bigger backlash towards the American government and any government, UK as well, and any other government who ridiculed the pilots, the brave people who came before forward with accounts that they weren't lying after all. But the way I look at that predicament is, and I've said for me what would work best is we can get into recrimination, but really we just want the truth and we have to move on to a new reality.
Right.
The way to do that would be to have a truth and reconciliation kind of commission, like they did in South Africa with the apartheid, when Nelson Mandela came in, rather than send people to prison left, right and centre. He basically just got them to apologise and said, look, we have to move on from this for the sake of the country. And I think that would be my kind of take on it, that these high-level politicians who've been keeping this secret would be brought in before a hearing, they would be put on the stand, and they would be forced to admit that they lied, blah, blah, blah. But then that's it, unless they've killed people.
I agree completely. And
we have to move on as a world.
We have to move on as a galactic civilization.
Absolutely. We're the human species. We're not countries. And even Reagan said that at the famous UN, that I often wonder, close to quote, I often wonder what would happen if extraterrestrial was real, and how we'd soon forget our local differences and speak together as one species, i.e. human sapien. And I think that's absolutely right, that we go away from the trivial my gang is better than your gang scenario, and we then start joining you would say galactic, I would say universal club, on an intelligent basis. And the way we do that is by acknowledging our mistakes and then coming collectively together and saying, look, you know, even if they said, look, well, okay, we thought it was for the right reasons because of the Cold War, then it carried on. We didn't know how to tell the truth because we'd lied for so long and we didn't know how to correct it. That's fine, as long as they admit their responsibility and they open up totally what they know, and we move into a world of open discussion on the subject, and let's get this ridicule factor out of the way.
I agree. For me, a big motivation of ending the truth embargo is that I know that we would not have war anymore. And when we reflect back on today, when we did this interview, we could likely say that, yes, in Syria on that day, they were letting off chemical weapons, and ending the truth embargo ends that. And that's why I hope a wealthy visionary will come forward and say, Gary, let's put out your feature film. Let's put out more truth. Let's have people feel this and get what we're talking about here.
Well, you know, that's a kind of utopian dream. But, yeah, you know, the way that I'm always surprised that, you know, you hear about celebrities who've seen E.T., you know, film stars who said, yeah, I've had an encounter. But if you really had, and you were really privately moved by that, then I've never understood it that they don't put their hand into the pocket either silently and say to approach people who are trying to do the right work and say, look, is 200 grand, get a really good quality magazine out here, tell the truth and I'll back you all the way, but don't ever mention my name. Or ultimately, in the sense that we talked about the Rockefeller Initiative and the millions of pounds that were spent on that. Well, again, somebody like him clearly wants to see something change. Well, for me, it changes if you start giving responsibility to the people that actually know the subject. How can people who don't know the subject come in and make it properly? It's ridiculous. It's like saying to a chef, you know, you'll get a trainee in to cook a great meal. It just won't happen. Yes, I'm not a film person. I've not got all my cinematography qualifications and editing skills and whatever. But basically, you would need to, if in a utopian world, it would take a huge benefactor to come forward and say, right, I believe in this. Yes, it could be important. Let's do it properly. And right. You work with these guys to tell the truth. And yes, they have got the skills, the physical and technical skills, but you are leading the way to tell it how it really is. And
you're right. That's very important.
That would be my take on it.
I agree.
Since I've retired, a couple of people who I've met in the film world and in TV production and things like that have approached me. And there are little things going on in the background. But I've said, look, right. You know, I want to retain a level of control, which is unheard of for somebody who has no street cred professionally. So I realise what a major thing that is. But, you know, they all now are coming to the conclusion that this is getting closer. So I think that it's possible that they're beginning to realise. It's like I've said for a long time that I'd like to do a write and present a TV series based on the best evidence from initially, I would say, Britain's best cases, but then Europe and the world, where right. I look at each case through police evidential eyes and look at it from both sides, sceptical and whatever. But the difference is that, unlike other TV series, I'd only go to the 3%. After investigation, that would be my starting point. And so, therefore, the sceptics really haven't got many places to go. But I'd certainly mention it. But if it's not credible, I'd say it doesn't add up. So it's not worthy of being a genuine, you know, sceptical point. I'm all for debate, but it has to be based on the evidence. And unfortunately, sceptics, by and large, in TV documentaries, just come out with generalisations. And because TV is not bothered or wants to be a proper referee, there is nobody there to say, well, actually, that doesn't add up, or you didn't say that 2 years ago. Whereas if it was a political investigation over something like the Clinton impeachment, that, you know, every word would be watched, and there'd be a referee saying, well, you said that in office 4 years ago. What are you saying now? You didn't say that then. We've nobody in the media world who can act as a referee. So we, in a sense, have to create our own referees by trying to get some kind of power in the production aspect.
Well, I would say to that, if anyone wants to see your talent in that, they should pay the $3.80 and look at the archives at the Citizens Hearing for Disclosure and look at your presentation from Thursday night and see what your style is. And I think people would love to see that on TV for all of these cases, you know?
Well, you know, I've done quite a lot of documentaries over the years, and they all kind of follow the same pattern now, that in the first 20 minutes they'll tell a good pilot case or a good part of the Rendlesham story, and then you'll have your sceptics will come in the next 20 minutes to talk about, oh, people looked at a lighthouse like in Rendlesham, they looked at stars, they looked at returning space debris, which totally out of context with what the witnesses who were actually there said, and is ludicrous, but they've got to get it in there because the bottom line is TV doesn't want to rock the boat. And in the last 20 minutes we're talking about the mythological aspect where people are stood on the top of a hill with a tin lid on their head going ummi ummi, you know, to make us all look stupid. And that's generally how most documentaries work. They start with the good stuff, then they start toning it down, and then they make it look like it is at the end. So the bottom line is nobody thinks anything different at the end of the programme. And that's been a stock where the TV media have dealt with it. Well, that needs to change. And I, you know, from my point of view, if I don't know what evidence is in terms of what would stand up in a court of law after 24 years of being a police officer, I wouldn't shoot it.
Right. And your style is very different from any that I've ever seen because of your investigation background. You present the evidence that in a way that if a 10-year-old kid was listening to it, they would get it.
Absolutely. You know, people can get bogged down in technicalities, but the bottom line is there are certain rules of evidence. The three general types of evidence is going to be your testimony from witnesses, from documentary evidence, papers that relate to that, i.e. the Holt Memorandum, and three, your physical evidence, which is actually called real evidence. So you've got those three types of evidence. Well, that's the nature in which our whole civilized system works on. But when it comes to UFOs, those three things get kicked into touch by the media and by investigative journalists. And that's wrong, because the evidence is there. And anybody at the citizens' hearings who heard the pilots and saw the reaction of the former congressmen and women and the senator would have no doubt be in exactly the same position if they were ever allowed to hear the truth.
Right.
And you're just not allowed to. So, you know, who knows whether we're moving closer. I do feel as if we are moving closer. How quick, I don't know. But I had a conversation with a fairly high-ranking, effectively very high-level player now in the UK media just before I went out to America for the hearings. And I said what I wanted to do, and he said, look, I think we're actually moving towards that now. And I think one of the reasons why that's happening, and we haven't touched upon it, is that we are very close, I think, to getting a mainstream breakthrough without the mention of UFOs, which is, I think, within the next 2 years, if not sooner, there will be an admission in the mainstream media that they've discovered microscopic biological life on Mars, whether it was once existed or it still existed, doesn't matter. But I think that is coming. The indications are that, you know, that. But when that happens, this will be the first brick that comes out of the dam and starts to leak the water, because the age-old question has always been: is there life out there? Well, if it's finally confirmed that there is any kind of life anywhere, that question is answered, and the answer would be yes if it's Mars. Wow, that's an amazing thing. Well, then what's the odds of two planets going around a small sun having life? at some point or any point. And the odds are now with Kepler, with over nigh on 1,000 exoplanets discovered by Kepler, and there are now quite a lot of planets that appear to have water. They're in the Goldilocks zone, not right. too hot, not too cold. So mainstream science and astronomy is coming to that conclusion that life is almost certainly abundant. But then once that brick comes out, it then just focuses on, well, yes, there's life out there. Almost certainly it's teeming, but what about the distances? But I've never understood the distance argument, because if you said to Leonardo da Vinci, who was my father's greatest thinker of his generation and many generations, if you right. passed him an iPad now and said, work that out, Leonardo, he would not have a clue because of the technological leap. Well, if that's only 400 years of technological advancement, what would happen if life had existed and emerged in an intellectual form on another planet in Earth's kind of timeline 100,000 years ago? That would mean that 100,000 years of evolution and technological development had taken place. Well, are you telling me that in that 100,000 years that they wouldn't have discovered ongoing methods of propulsion? Well, look at us. 100 years ago, the Wright brothers flew for the first time
right.
under powered flight. Well, look right. where we've gone in that 100 years. You know, we're now travelling beyond our solar system. We can see via Kepler and Hubble into deep space. People cannot get their heads around the number of stars in the universe, in our galaxy alone, never mind the universe. Every day there is new discoveries. So, for me, it's a ludicrous argument. If planets of life is teeming in the universe, some will have developed ahead of the Earth, and therefore they will have developed new methods of propulsion. And therefore, what seemed like impossible, i.e. speed of light, travel between the stars, it really is the Star Trek kind of scenario of moving between the stars. I really don't think it's an issue at all, and it's really science being very narrow-minded. But when that breakthrough comes, when life is acknowledged in the mainstream of any kind, that really starts the signal of when the dam begins to break.
Right. And just to comment and bring in the citizens' hearing on disclosure regarding this, I think it was not Gravel or Cook, but what was the third man's name?
Bartlett.
Yes, but Bartlett was saying, he kept mentioning about how can this be and light years and all that. And Dr. Thomas Vallone was the one explaining. I have mastered zero point technology. So have many other scientists. I was thrown out of my job for 6 years. I had to go to court to get my job back because they were trying to suppress the science. And they have been for a long time.
Absolutely.
We have propulsion with zero point technology, and you know, M.T. Keshi, the nuclear physicist from Iran, he's based in Italy now. He has all these patents for this propulsion technology. Not only that, but regarding life out there, Stephen Bassett last summer was saying he felt there would be an October surprise. And what they were talking about was maybe the potential was they were going to announce they had found water on Mars. Well, I did a Google search and I noticed going back to 1980, I could find articles in papers like the New York Times, if not the New York Times, saying scientists are saying they found water on Mars. Well, you know, I was a registered nurse. Everybody knows this. Wherever there's water, there's bacteria and viruses. Yep. And also Dr. Wood, who was at the hearings, Dr. Robert Wood, has a new book coming out called Alien Viruses. I guess Richard Dolan's going to be publishing that one. So all of these arguments, I mean, we already have this evidence. We already have this technology. Enough already. That's why I like to emphasize saying those of you out there who understand this and you have hundreds of millions of dollars and even hundreds of billions of dollars, these projects are set forth to help the truth come out. So we just need a little hand up here and we could really break this for the whole world.
And that's in a sense why I've chosen to retire now, because I feel the time is right for me to try to make a bigger contribution than I was doing before, because I think I've got a voice, and I think it's a voice that people do generally accept as being a reasoned voice in terms of evidence, that something tells me I've got to do it now, and hence why I'm launching the magazine and devoting my life to it. And it's called UFO Truth Magazine, because it's just after that. It's just after the truth on the subject. And it will be, and most of the top researchers have agreed to either be regular columnists or guest contributors to it. If you look at the website that's up and running now, UFO Truth Magazine, you'll see that list. And I would guess that there isn't a better lineup anywhere.
I have this list up here, so let me read it. AJ Gavard from Brazil, Peter Robbins from the US, Roberto Pinetti from Italy, Mary Rodwell from Australia, Bill Chalker from Australia, Suzanne Hansen from New Zealand, Julio Chamorro from Peru.
Yeah.
And then it goes on, you know, from the UK, Anthony Beckett, Richard D. Hall, Alan Foster, David Caton, Bridget Barkley, Dave Holdren, and it keeps going on. And then guest contributors, Robert Salas, Andrew Johnson from the UK, Steve Bassett from the US, Richard Dolan, Grant Cameron from Canada, Stanton Freeman from Canada, Peter Davenport from the US. So this is, isn't this a subscription-based magazine then? How does it work?
Right, it works like this. It's going to be a bi-monthly online e-zine. I.e. it's not be paperback. There's far too many people. It would cost between 50 and 100,000 pounds in the UK to put a specialist printed magazine together. I don't have that kind of money, and then there's no success. Now the technology is there because of people are happy to now read off a computer screen that a few years ago they weren't. So now you can get rid of all those costs, and we can now have an online publication that you can read on your mobile phone, that you can read on your tablet, that you can read on your iPad or any other tablet device. And we're happy to do that now. It'll turn the pages just like a book with your Kindle, your Kobo.
It's green, which is the best.
Absolutely, you know. So there's minimal overheads, and it now means that we can collectively put a magazine together. Initially, it will start off at 84 pages, but I think even with the first issue, it's probably likely to go to 96 pages. It's going to be a colour magazine. It'll look just like any other glossy magazine, but it's online. It'll be in a PDF initially, and then it'll be converted to various formats for your tablets, etc. It's the website's up and running now. The first issue, it's going to be bi-monthly. The first issue is going to go out on the 25th of June. The website's already up and running, and you can take a yearly subscription out, and there's an early subscription offer on. It's all done via PayPal, so whatever currency it is, it'll convert it. And that's what will happen. But here's the thing, as I've said to you and said to many others, what will make this magazine different is that I'm doing it for the passion. I'm not doing it to make money. What I've said in the mission statement is this, that the first, a third of all monies raised, a third, 33.5%, or a third, 33 and a third, I guess, of all monies raised through subscriptions will be set aside for UFO causes. That means initially that will help fund British ufology, creating a self-funding mechanism to get conferences to pay for speakers and things like that, because that needs to be established in the UK. But then the idea is that as the magazine hopefully gets bigger, and hence why I've got top people from all around the world and a lot of the countries, and I still want to get other countries involved, but in make it a global magazine for people that genuinely believe that ET is here. And that's the criteria. It's there in the mission statement. This is for people that believe that some UFOs are ET, engaging the Earth, which I personally believe 100%. You will never get me changing that. So it's unequivocal. This is a magazine for believers that will look at the evidence dispassionately and say the evidence is there. So we do that. A third of all money is raised. Well, can you imagine that if people start taking the magazine around the world in real numbers, that pot of money is going to grow. For example, if you had just 5,000 people worldwide, That would probably generate £100,000, probably $150,000, of which then a third of that, $50,000, is that set aside for UFO causes. Where else have we ever had that kind of funding mechanism? I'm not out to make a profit. I'm out to show the truth and get the, and produce the best evidence for the people out there.
And generate more truth. And I just want to interject, I've already paid for mine.
Yes, yes, you have, which I would have... which I would have actually given you for free, but there you go. Thank you.
No, because I'm doing it for passionate reasons too. We have to put our money where our mouth is.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the frustrations that will be is that everybody says beyond pornography, when you search on the internet, pornography being apparently the number one search thing, the second thing is UFOs. But that's not translated into people who turn up at conferences. And it's a real worry for me that there's so many millions, probably billions of people around the world who are armchair UFO enthusiasts, but they won't do anything about it to make things happen. And they can make things happen by spending a few pounds, what is £16 in English money, probably $24 or whatever in the US.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought it was $23.
Year's subscription to a magazine that will have the best writers in the world, the best researchers in the world. It's not a lot of money to pay for a belief. If you sit on your armchair and just write your own little blog, well, that's all well and good, but it isn't going to change anything politically. But I do believe if the masses just put their hands into the pocket, we can then start having forensic tests done on cattle mutilation cases. When somebody says to me, and that's the idea of having this pot of money, is that basically when they come to me, they can ask for a grant. We've got a forensic test for a vet that we need doing in Chile. Can you give us a grant? Well, if I've got the money, then I'll give them it. And that's the idea, that the more people actually put money into it, the more this pot will be there for the benefit of the subject. Not for me, for the benefit of the subject.
Absolutely. And the people have to come together to undo the truth embargo. And this is how we do it, step by step.
Absolutely. You know, it's never been done before like this. And the technology is just now perfect. People are happy to read off the screens. Years ago, I used to run a little online magazine just for a few people in the UK, basically. But people would say, oh, can you print it off for us? I hate reading it off the screen. Well, that's changed completely now. And I think even on the likes of Amazon, ebooks have overtaken the printed book. Which is still nice, and I still wish in some ways it was printed. But now we have an opportunity where people are happy to read off their iPads, the tablet, telephones, the smartphones. So now there's no reason why not to do it now.
Absolutely.
Go on, you've stopped.
I know. I'm still deeply affected by what happened at the citizens' hearing. You know, the gravity of what's happened in the last few weeks is staggering and beautiful.
Well, I perhaps am more cautious and more pragmatic than you, and a realist maybe more. I'm cautiously optimistic that something is happening. And if we could get a country, I'll say a country, to come forward with the UN, for me, that would be the best route. I've spoken to Senator Gravel, and he's now on a vacation, I think, in Europe. But he's promised to do an article for UFO Truth magazine, which would be obviously a big exclusive. And I'm also going to be in contact with Congresswoman Kilpatrick, who was obviously one of those people very moved by the testimony given. So I'm hopeful that can lead to a meaningful dialogue.
Congresswoman Kilpatrick said that we owe it to our children and our grandchildren and our God to look into this topic more.
Absolutely. And our task was not to make them ET believers, but it was to make them think. By presenting the evidence, we made them think and we made them realize just how significant the evidence as a whole is and persuasive to the ET theory. Now, they had never been presented with anything of that kind of basis. And probably if this kind of scenario had never come up, if Steve hadn't been given a lot of money to set this up, they right. would have never ever took the time to sit down and listen to over 30 odd hours of testimony like that. But they did, and they did have to sit and listen to it. And having listened to just 4 or 6 hours of it, they were blown away by it. Now, right. why should they be any different to any other congressman? Just because they've retired doesn't mean they've lost their brains.
At the end of the first day, when you were telling the story about how Congresswoman Kilpatrick stood up and said, we need this to be a congressional hearing, my reaction was, look, everybody, Stephen Bassett spent $500,000 and he has created a congressional hearing as good as any congressional hearing can be. And you're hearing the truthful testimony of the leading researchers and historians and witnesses in the world. So this is our congressional hearing. You're hearing it now.
It is. I can't think, other than being a representative for the UK, which I'd like to be if we ever get to a UN debate.
Yeah.
I can't think that there's anything I'll ever do more significant than what I did at the at the citizens' hearing.
Absolutely, and I think that's what I mean when I say that it was such a staggering thing. No one can take the witness testimony away. It's out there now.
Well, one of the things, just going back to that, that I had to pinch myself at times,
is
that when you were so close to the panel of six senator and five congressmen and women, literally just 25 feet away from the panel of researchers, witnesses, and there was this dialogue going on, I had to pinch myself when you've got Senator Gravel and Senator and Congressman Bartlett discussing openly about UFO chases and craft being shot at and things like that. Can you imagine them that ever happening other than this environment of a hearing?
They never
ever had any of those kind of debates. So it was incredible. When Merrill Cook, his jaw was on the floor when he heard the pilot testimonies. It was literally, he was gobsmacked, and tried to be fairly sceptical for all the week. Very nice man.
Yeah, he did. He did a good job.
He did a good job.
Of being neutral, yeah.
Absolutely knocked for six. His body language is he might as well have been Rocky and in the film and been beaten up by Carl Weathers, you know. So he was on the ropes, because where do you go with a pilot saying, I took off and I chased this thing and I shot it? How much direct evidence do you want?
Right. And there were 1,800 witnesses to that event, so they didn't even try to cover that up.
Absolutely, but, you know, it just shows you that, as what we've already known in the community, the UFO community, is that the evidence is overwhelming. And to be honest, I'm going to say this, and it might be controversial, but I think I have to say this. When at that same kind of, on the same day of that, Congressman Merrill asked Nick Pope, who was there, the only other UK, although he's now US based, he was there and his jaw was on the floor with the quality of the witness testimony. And he asked Nick Pope, well, what do you think? Well, Nick Pope said, well, along the lines of, well, I'm not convinced yet, or I'm not there yet with the ET. That's a daft way of saying I don't know. Well, I felt that that was a kick in the teeth to Steve, to be honest, because he was there, surely, to say the very opposite of that. And I pretty much knew and suspected that Nick would say that, because that's what Nick always does. But, you know, realistically...
Well, he's done that in the YouTubes that we've listened to here, where he always announces that he has no plans of saying anything, you know, that he's taking a neutral stance on everything.
Well, he's a typical civil servant who worked for the British government for many years, so he's well trained in that. But I find that very frustrating. And what I would say is that if we ever came to go into the UN, you would need people that were fully committed to the ET hypothesis, and not people who want to sit on the fence. That's what I would say on that.
The same thing happened with Merrill with Dr. Sun, what I was saying before. Dr. Sun's testimony was so shocking that he interrupted him, you know.
He couldn't deal with it.
No, he couldn't.
The evidence, we know that the evidence is, when you put it in that structured way, is highly compelling. Because what else could it be? We're not talking about little lights in the sky. We're not talking about anything that's easy to explain. We're talking about structured craft moving in the Earth's airspace in ways that make our planes look like the Wright brothers 100 years ago in terms of maneuverability. So, clearly are dealing with an extraterrestrial present.
The other thing that happened in the Citizens Hearing for Disclosure was what Dr. Sun was saying at that time was that he was giving a witness account of an interaction between a human and an extraterrestrial. We also heard the videotape from anonymous witness, the CIA agent who worked for the Army, saying he interviewed an extraterrestrial at Area 51 at S4. And so we also had accountings of, you know, contacts.
Absolutely. And there's no two ways about it. There is contact going on. But I don't have a difficulty with it. I fully accept it. But in what I try to do is try to reach out to the common person on the street. And if you just go up to the person on the street and say and talk about alien abduction and ET contact, then it's just off their credibility scale to 99% of the people. So you have to bring people in through the evidential basis, which is what I try to do, the pilots, the astronauts, the cosmonauts, the radar operators, et cetera, the police officers. So that's the way to engage them to open up their minds. And then once the minds are open, that's when you can talk about abductions and implants and animal mutilations. But to a person on the street, it's just too much to deal with, in the same way that you could see that some of the panel members were absolutely, just couldn't get their heads around mutilations, animal mutilations, why we're doing it, and human harvesting and all that, you know. It's a very difficult thing. So people come at it at different ways, but what the Citizens Hearing got absolutely right is it concentrated on what is, I would say, the best evidence that would stand up in a court of law. And the witnesses were on there, were talking about aircraft that had been involved in intercepts and things like that. There was talk of, there was a document session about documents that had been unearthed that prove that there is high level discussion on this subject, you know,
right.
And then
you look, well,
so. So if you see what I mean, you know, it was done for me in exactly the right way. You have to reach out to the person on the street first to just say, look, hey, listen to us. We're not crazy. Just give us a chance. And I actually said that in one of my answers during the one session that I was on, is when there was a danger that they were going to go off into this philosophical debate about something. And I said, no, we're here to actually listen to the evidence, to present that over the week. We ain't got time to wait on philosophical debate, because we haven't. That seemed to go down well. But that's why we were there, to show the evidence that will then allow the conditions at some point in the future where, if we can get a UN resolution that basically people can then start coming out of the woodwork of all ranks without fear of risk to their career, censure, being sent to prison for breaking oaths, etc. And basically we move forward from that. But the Citizens Hearing was fantastic. It will, you know, long stay with me as probably the best thing I've ever done in the subject.
Oh, yeah, and I agree. And another thing I'd like to point out is we haven't spoken today about Dr. Stephen Greer, and I don't think it's a mistake that the Sirius movie came out a week before the Citizens Hearing. And I think the Sirius movie is engaging the man on the street, because I noticed, on purpose, I went out to the man on the street during this whole time, during the Citizens Hearing and since I came back, and asked people about this topic. And they'll say to me now, I think I heard something about that. And I think the Sirius movie did that. I know that Stephen Bassett needs $2 million so that he can have control over distribution of the truth embargo. We need to get that movie out there. And I'll reiterate again how important it would be to bring your feature film out. And these projects are what brings it to the world.
Oh, they're game changers if done properly, and that's right. Where we're at now. If done properly, they are potentially game changers that make that breakthrough. So if, like I said, with all the celebrities out there, I'm always amazed that somebody, either publicly or privately, doesn't put his hand into his pocket, a Tom Cruise kind of character. I'm not saying him for any
James Cameron.
You need somebody who believes in this topic, even if it's Spielberg, to say secretly, here's 25 million, go get this done, because the world needs this.
Absolutely. And these guys have more money than they can ever use. Right. Where's the money? We need the money now.
I never understand why the money isn't there, and why Steve, for years and years, has been scrimping and scraping, and like all
right.
people who organise conferences, where are the business people who believe in this, who've had abduction experiences themselves, or have seen something themselves, who can make a difference? We need these people not to get off the backside, but to put their hand in the pocket and say, look, I want to make a difference, and I'll put my money where my mouth is, and I'll give it to people who will use the money wisely to get the truth out there. They can change things.
They can do that, and they can do it anonymously.
Absolutely. It doesn't matter. They can be public, or they can be a silent partner in the funding. But I can never understand why many people who, and it can't be a mistake that these people in high level positions haven't had similar experiences, because I'm sure they do, that they haven't come forward, most likely privately, to say, I'll support you. Here's the money. Let's get this done. Because it's a drop in the ocean what it would take to actually make a breakthrough, if done properly.
That's right. Gary, I guess we're going to wrap it up now, but I want to say what a privilege it's been to get to know you at the Citizens Hearing, and to a privilege to have you here today to speak on these things.
Beth, you want me on any time, we'll talk.
That sounds really good. Best to you on all of your endeavors. You're doing a wonderful, wonderful work.
I'm trying, but as I say, I'm not religious, I'm not spiritual, but I do feel as if something is compelling me to go down the route of research that I've done for the last 11 years, and now chosen to retire early to devote myself to this subject. And we have to start moving towards political mechanisms to get this brought to the world.
Yeah, we're moving in the right direction.
Great. I think so. I hope so.
Yeah.
I've certainly enjoyed speaking to you, Beth, and it's a pleasure getting to know you.
You bet. We'll talk soon. Thank you.
Yeah, anytime you want me, you let me know.
You bet.
Sounds awful, that, doesn't it? I should rephrase that. Really,
you take care, Gary Heseltine.
You got the pronunciation right. Well done. Let me know the feedback and send me a copy if you can.
I will. I'll be seeing you soon. You take care.
All right, then. Be good. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you, everybody. It's fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for being here today. Namaste.